is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're on our last case for this week, 03-0288, Jane E. Chen versus John J. Warner. Representing Mr. Warner, Linda Roberts. Ms. Wilkerson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Linda Roberson. I represent Dr. John Warner. With me at counsel table and with me on the brief is Attorney Holly Slota. This appeal presents a fundamental challenge to traditional stereotyped roles of fatherhood and motherhood. Historically, fathers were supposed to support their families while mothers stayed home and cared for the children. But in the 21st century, these roles have changed. Most families now have two income producers, and necessarily childcare responsibilities are shared by the parents. The Chin-Warner marriage was a 21st century marriage. Both parents are highly compensated professionals. When they divorced, they agreed to divide childcare equally between them, and they further agreed that each of them would support the children when the children were in his or her care. These changing parental roles color the legal issues presented by this case. Had Dr. Warner decided post-divorce that he should now devote himself full-time to parenting and seek child support from Dr. Chin, we would not hesitate to hold him to his existing obligations.
I would. Yeah, right. I don't think that matters as to gender. I mean, if your whole argument is based on we're in a new society, and I should hope we are on a personal level, it doesn't matter to me which one it is. What matters to me is these children are well cared for. And what matters to me is you and I may differ as to whether the child needs a full-time parent at home or should be put in daycare, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I agree with you that the decisions that are made with respect to these issues should be gender neutral.
I have a question that relates not to gender, but to the role of the trial court versus the role of the appellate court. We have a trial court decision which did not favor your client. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the trial court saw the two parties, had opportunities to speak to them, looked at the record. Was it the same judge that granted the divorce?
That I don't know, Your Honor. I don't believe that's in the record.
But to what extent on a discretionary, we agree that child support's discretionary?
A decision with respect to child support is a discretionary decision, Your Honor.
All right.
With respect to a decision as to whether a person is shirking his or her child support obligation, however, the Court of Appeals in the Van Offren case has made it clear that we have a mixed question of fact and law. It is entitled to de novo review with appropriate deference to the trial court. And I think one significant issue
of what?
I'm sorry?
De novo review of what?
A de novo review of the question of law.
What question of law?
The question of law in this case is whether, in light of her existing child support obligations, it was reasonable for Dr. Chin to retire at age 43, to not look for part-time work, and to refuse to invade her $1.7 million estate for the support of her children.
Does that equal shirking?
I believe it does, Your Honor. I believe the case law previously existing in Wisconsin makes it very clear that it does.
So the question of law is, do the facts proved and found by the trial court constitute shirking?
That's correct. And, Your Honor, I believe that the appropriate reading of Van Offren, which is not the reading that it was given by the Court of Appeals in this case, is that the appropriate deference, that's a direct quote from Van Offren, the appropriate deference that the reviewing court owes to the trial court is deference to the trial court's findings of fact. For precisely the reasons you mentioned, Your Honor, the courts there can judge the credibility. Once those facts have been found, then the reviewing court should review the legal issue here de novo. And in this case, I believe that there is no dispute as to the underlying facts.
Counselor, does your client object to the mother of the children spending time with them, or is it just the financial arrangement that he objects to?
Of course he doesn't object to Dr. Chan spending time with the party's children. He spends tremendous time with the party's children himself.
Okay, so the question is not whether she chooses to spend all of her time with her kids or not. The question is whether he has to participate in that in a financial way. Is that correct?
I think the question, Your Honor, is whether under these circumstances, where placement is shared equally and where the children are in school full-time.
Well, they're not in school full-time in the summer, but go ahead.
Well, that's true. But whether under these circumstances, we're not dealing with babies, we're not dealing with a child with special needs, we're dealing with a dad who was fully involved in the children's lives and has placement 50% of the time, whether it is reasonable for her, A, not to be employed at all, even during...
That's the question, though. I mean, to me, there are two questions. One question is, does he object to her deciding to spend all of her time with the children? If the answer to that is no, the only thing I see left is that he's being asked to participate in it financially. Right? I mean, what else is there besides that, unless he doesn't think she ought to be spending all her time with the kids? I mean, he may think it's a bad example that moms ought to work, and that's a good example for the kids. I don't know. That's what I'm asking you.
The fact is that she does not spend all the time with the kids, even under the best
circumstances.
You're not
answering my question.
She doesn't.
You're not answering
but,
my question.
But yes, Your Honor, you're getting to, I think, what is the crux of the issue in this case, which is that when somebody makes a unilateral decision to change the parenting style that has been in place and has worked well during the marriage and in the years immediately subsequent to divorce, can you stick the other person with the tab?
No.
And I think the answer is no.
There are two separate questions. Unless he believes that, A, she shouldn't be spending all this time with the children, that may be his position, I don't know. There are two separate questions. One is her spending all the time with the children. Now, if she never asked him for a dollar, would we ever have any complaints here? Would this go on for 15 years until the kids were out of the home and in college? That's what I'm trying to get to. Or is it just the financial participation that he objects to?
If she never asked for a dollar, he would not have this form, because there would be no court case. We're in court because she asked him for money, because she chose not to work at all, even though the kids are with her only part-time.
I understand that gives you the forum to bring it in, because she asked for an adjustment on child support. If she hadn't made that motion, you're right, we wouldn't be in court. But once we're in court, he can take whatever defenses he chooses, I would think, to the motion and the change in the circumstances that we're presented with.
Well, he has not been asked before, I don't believe, by anyone in the whole process here, whether he would object to her spending 24 hours a day with the children every day, 7 days a week. But I believe that his answer would be, yes, he would object, because we have a 50-50 placement schedule, and his time with the children is also important. It does free her to contribute to her own support.
Counsel, I just want to ask, do you think that this case has public policy implications as far as what happened here?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. This is a published decision. And so, despite the fact that the Court of Appeals majority, I think, tried to limit its application and to say this holding only applies in these somewhat unusual facts, I think there is application here. Anytime you have a parent who has been employed on a full-time basis and who decides to reduce or eliminate his or her participation in the labor market to spend more time with the children, I think this case has ramifications that go far beyond these particular people in this particular situation.
Well, this would not only affect what we would say is two high-income individuals. It could affect whatever decision we come to would affect people of moderate income.
I believe that's true, Your Honor, and I would point out to the Court that Family Court Commissioner Lucy E. Cooper from Milwaukee is here in the courtroom today because of her concern that the cases that come before her on a daily basis are going to be affected by the ramifications of this case. This is not a situation where we're going to have one law for the rich and one law for the rest of us. This case has more zeros than most of the cases that we see. These people have bigger balance sheets, but the issues apply to everyone.
Counselor, doesn't the balance sheet make a difference in regard to whether or not they're shirking? If someone has $500,000 in income, is that a factor that we ought to consider as opposed to someone that might have $15,000 worth of income and a spouse that decides not to work?
Given the case law that exists today, Your Honor, I would have to say the answer to that question is no. The issue is whether she is shirking in light of her own ability to contribute to the children's support, not whether she's shirking in light of someone else's ability. I think both the trial court and the Court of Appeals got off track with respect to that very issue, and I appreciate you bringing it up. The issue is whether what she did was reasonable in light of her existing obligation to support the kids. If you look at the Van
Hollen... But isn't her obligation somewhat tied to the father's obligation to support the children? They're both obliged to support them.
That's true. And his ability to pay, I think, becomes relevant to the extent that her ability to pay is not sufficient to provide the children with an appropriate lifestyle.
Now, this case, because you have... equal division of the children. In other words, 1 week here and 1 week there. In your opinion, what I see about this case, the big difference is only that there's money here. That's why I asked about the public policy concerns. And I'm wondering about the reasonableness of that concern, I'm talking about the money concern, when we balance all of the other equities in this case. As I understand it, your client spends about 40%. It's equal, but because Mrs. Chen is not employed, she spends a bit more, say 10% more time. Is that...
Your Honor,
I
think the record reflects that because Dr. Chin is not employed outside the home, she is on occasion at her choice available for the children during Dr. Warner's placement, after school and so on. She is not required to be there. He still has to provide backup care in case she's not. But she, in the past at least, did take advantage of the opportunity to spend some time with the children during his week of placement.
One last question. Is this changed in any way because now all three children are of school age and there's, in other words, when they're in school, I assume that they do not need any care at that time. Or does that make any difference?
Well, the irony of this case, Your Honor, and I think you've pointed to it very clearly, is that when the children were babies, when they were very young, many mothers would like to be at home with their children full-time or at least part-time, the decision was made in this family that the way they were going to care for their children was that both parents would continue to be employed full-time. They would have good backup child care, and they would both spend considerable time with the children when they were not at work. That was the standard that was used in this family, and the record indicates that the children flourished under that arrangement. Now, when there isn't any reason relating to the children's needs for a change, when the children are in school full-time and there's less need for a nanny and less opportunity for a parent to be involved in the children, and again, when they're with their dad 50% of the time and he's being an active involved parent during that period of time, it just seems odd that Dr. Chin would say she could not work at all in order to be available to the children.
This is a shirking case.
This is a shirking case, Your Honor.
As I read the case law, Van Offren, you have to establish that Dr. Chen intentionally is avoiding the duty to support. Did you establish that, do you think?
Your Honor, with due respect, I don't believe that that is the rule anymore. I think the law of shirking, as it was established in the early 1980s, did contain that kind of language, and I believe that Attorney Tess Mattner cited to some of those cases, the Edwards case from 1980, the Wallen case from 1987. I believe that as the law has developed, our courts have made it very clear that you don't have to prove bad motives.
Van Offren, which is 92, and that's what I'm reading. Shirking is established when the obligor intentionally avoids the duty to support. Then it says, or. So do you think that she's intentionally avoiding the duty to support? Facts show that?
Your Honor, whether she was intentionally avoiding her duty to support is something that has not been argued before.
That's what I'm just trying to find out. What does shirking mean? Now, the other point is where the obligor unreasonably diminishes or terminates his or her income in light of the support obligation. Is that
that's
the one
correct.
You're coming under? Okay.
And that's where we've okay. hung our hat here.
All right. So what you have to do is show facts that constitutes unreasonable diminution or termination of income. Now, there's no question that her income has been diminished or terminated, right? All right.
That's correct.
So now, does the trial court then have to decide, and then the appellate court have to decide, whether that is unreasonable in light of the fact that these children are of school age, and therefore, theoretically, I mean, according to you, they need less mother care?
I think the standard is whether her decision is unreasonable in light of her existing obligation to support the children. And I believe the burden of proof is on Dr. Chen to show that her actions are reasonable. I don't think she can do that. If the standard of reasonableness is appropriately focused on reasonable in light of her child support obligation, as opposed to the more global look at reasonableness that I think is what took the trial court and the Court of Appeals off track.
Counsel, I want to go back to the beginning of your comments, and that is with regard to the standard of review. I'm not sure that I am in accord with your interpretation of the standard of review, so I want to tell you mine, and then I want to see if it meshes with yours. Mine, based on my interpretation of Van Offren, is that reasonableness is generally a question of law. A question of law is one that this court reviews de novo, afresh. However, when it comes to shirking their analysis, there is an exception to that general rule, and that the court owes appropriate deference to the trial court's determination of reasonableness, because reasonableness, although normally an issue of law, is so intertwined with the factual underpinnings. Now, that is how I understand the standard of review. But I heard in your recitation something a little different. I heard in your recitation that there's no deference except for facts. Did I misunderstand you?
Your Honor, I think I agree with everything you said as far as it went, but I would go further. And I think the thing that we're all struggling with is, what does appropriate deference mean? Van Offren doesn't give us any further explanation. It just says appropriate deference.
Well, it explains why you give it appropriate deference,
yes.
Because in shirking, well, it's so intertwined with the underpinning factual.
That's right.
Okay, but other than that, you're right.
So we have an issue of law that is reviewed de novo, but because there is this intertwining of factual and legal issues, the court in Van Offren said, and this is a direct quote, "We review the trial court's ruling as a question of law, but one to which we must pay appropriate deference." Now, if you read...
So what does that mean? You paid deference to the factual determinations and then still determine the law separately, or you paid deference to the legal conclusion based upon those facts?
I believe what you said first, Justice Butler, is the correct interpretation.
That's what I heard you say, and that's what I disagree with in Van Offen. I mean, we oftentimes, in many cases, have what we call this two-tier, is the phrase we use, two-tier analysis and standard of review. And that is, we review the historical facts, you know, with giving discretion, but as a matter of law, then we do it de novo. And that two-tier is something different than I see in the Van Offen language. It isn't the clear, and it's because of the explanation the court gives. It isn't that we review the facts, the historical facts, with some deference, and the law de novo, but this, whatever it is a special animal, shirking, paragraph 5, ordinarily an appellate court need not defer to the trial court's determination of question of law. However, because the trial court's legal conclusions as to reasonableness, which this is what it's all about in this case, is so intertwined with the factual findings supporting that conclusion, that an appellate court should give weight to the trial court's reasonableness conclusion. So I read that as saying, hey, in a lot of cases, facts, law, we can have this two-tier analysis, but here, because of the uniqueness of the intertwining, it isn't so clearly set forth as Justice Butler gave in the first part of his question.
I agree that the language in the Van Offen case is problematic, and I hope that the Court will take this opportunity to clarify the standard of review.
I didn't read the Ozaukee County case. I'm trying to get it at the moment. But that language is very typical in administrative law decisions, starting at least with not a Stein, but then before that, where the general rule is you give deference to the administrative agency as to facts, but not as to law. And the exception in not a Stein was where there's intertwining, because it looks so factual and is so factual. So that, and Ozaukee County versus Flessis, which this language comes from, is not a marital case, obviously.
That's correct.
My assumption, which we may be proved wrong in moments, is that it may be an administrative agency case and may very well cite to not a Stein, but we'll look at that. So this language doesn't need very much clarity if you look at other areas of the law, which says, okay, it's somewhere between full de novo and full deference.
Well, as I looked at the reasonableness issue in other contexts, I also went outside of the family law context because I couldn't find an answer in the family law context. It seemed that in most other contexts, the court was doing what I am asking this court to do, to review the legal issue de novo with deference to the facts as found by the trial court. And I look at the language in Van Offen that says, we review the trial court's ruling as a question of law, but one to which we must pay appropriate deference. Now, I don't know how you review it as a question of law if you're simply going to defer. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals did. I think they simply deferred and treated it as a misuse of discretion case. Now, I do think I win either way, because I think the issue of reasonableness, which she has the burden to prove for, if you look at that issue appropriately, reasonableness in light of her financial obligations to the children.
Where do we focus for the reasonableness? At the time of the retirement or at the time that she seeks the child support having not gotten another job?
Thank you for raising that issue, because this is another place where I have disagreed with the trial court and the Court of Appeals. I believe that it is appropriate for this court to look at both decisions that she made. The courts below have seen fit only to look at the decision not to return to work after the stock market didn't do what she had hoped it would do. But since he has had no option to have that initial decision reviewed, and since her decision at that point is something that fully implicates him and is right now costing him a lot of money. I think that since he has to pay the bill, he is entitled to have both questions reviewed by this court, and I believe that each of them individually is not reasonable in light of her obligation to support the children. I believe that taken together as a whole, these decisions are not reasonable in light of her obligation to support the children.
Do we ever look at anything else other than the obligation to support the children? I mean, do we look at the children were ill, if one of them had a special problem in school? I mean, you're concentrating on that, and rightly so, because that's what Van Offen says. But there must be other factors.
Your Honor, if the children are ill, if circumstances have changed, then you go back to court for a review of child support based on those changed circumstances. In this case, there are no changed circumstances. Or the circumstances that have changed, as one of you pointed out earlier, are that the children are now in school full-time, and so she should be more available for work rather than less. Certainly, if a child had developed an illness, that would be a reason for the court to go in and look at the family's changed circumstances and make a different child support obligation.
All right. So just support. You're just looking at support here, and there were no other factors set forth in the trial. Is that right?
That's correct. The only issue before the court was whether she should be able to make Dr. Warner pay the bill for her unilateral decision to be available full-time for the children, even though they are only with her half the time.
But, Counselor, if you prevail, then what you want us to write in our opinion is that the child support order is reversed and he pays zero.
I am asking this court to vacate that child support order, yes.
And that's the only thing you're asking for?
That's correct. I hope the court will clarify the standard of review and clarify the meaning of reasonableness. But what I want for Dr. Warner today is vacating that judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Roberson, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Kent A. Testmantner, representing Dr. Chen.
Please, the court. I am Kent Testmantner. Sitting at counsel table with me is trial counsel James Kurth. Also present in court is Jane Chen. I would like to, I have obviously some argument prepared, but I'd like to respond to some of the questions that you asked to give you the other side. First of all, Chief Justice Abrams said it was the same judge who granted the judgment of divorce that also held this hearing and made the decision that's under review, and that's reflected in the record because the findings, in fact, and conclusions of the law and judgment of divorce are in the record.
Of the original proceeding?
Correct.
And they were before the judge when he dealt with this second proceeding?
Correct. Same judge. So that answers one of your questions there. Also that I just wanted to indicate a couple things here. As far as our argument is basically this, and I will address the standard review issues too when we get to that. But I think one of the things that I did not hear during the argument on behalf of Dr. Warner was the best interests of the children standard. I did not hear that anywhere.
Is it relevant?
I believe it is. And the reason I believe it is because you are asking whether we're looking at finances only. We are not. And we are looking at the what's in the best interest of the children.
Where do you find that? I didn't see that in Van Offen.
I don't believe it's in Van Offen. However, what I did, Your Honor, is I went through and did a survey of all of the cases on shirking, and it's difficult to come up with a list, and the courts all say it's fact-specific. This case is fact-specific. The facts in this particular case are that Dr. Chen reduced her income for the best interests of the children, what she perceived to be their best interests. What's unique about this case, and I do talk about that in my brief to this court, is that at trial, Dr. Warner agreed that with all of the principles that Mr. Kurth asked him about whether it's preferable for children to be cared for a parent rather than a nanny, he agreed. Whether it's preferable for children to maximize their time with parents, he agreed. The only qualification he had to any of the policy reasons that Dr. Chen used for reducing her income was if you can afford it. And the Court of Appeals, the trial court, and this court should all find that this is a case where he can afford it.
Isn't Mr. Kent, Mr. Testmattner, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Isn't really, if I can paraphrase Dr. Warner's argument, the issue is whether Dr. Chen can unilaterally make a decision regarding the full family income, if you will, the income that is provided to the family in such a way so that it negatively impacts on the other person. I don't think anybody would disagree as to the value of a parent, either parent, being around their children. The question is, can one parent make a decision that binds both?
And I agree that that's an issue to be faced in this case. Another, and I'll answer it, but I'll answer it by telling you that when I looked through the case law again comes back to the children. The case law comes back to, does this decision harm the children? And tied up with the answer to that question is there enough money to do this? And the answer is yes. This is an unusual case. This is a case where Dr. Warner testified that he has $12,000 per month of after-tax discretionary income that he doesn't know what to do with.
So, counsel, I asked opposing counsel this question.
A little bit of a gloss on there, but he did testify that other than buying vehicles with it, honeymoon, he puts it in a A.G. Edwards account. So he's investing that money. So he does invest.
He knows what to do with it.
He does.
So that's after he fulfills his budget. He has $12,000 of after-tax income left over?
That's correct. That's undisputed in the record. Justice Wilcox, did you have a question?
I was going to say, then this case is about money, then? It's about the having the adequate support, the adequate funds to from one side to support the children?
I believe it's about exactly what the Court of Appeals said it was about. And I believe the Court of Appeals' reasons for upholding the trial court decision are what this case is about. This case is about benefits to the children that have occurred because of Dr. Chen's decision, and they're set forth and spread on in the Court of Appeals' decision for several pages long, benefits to the child and whether there's sufficient money to afford those benefits.
Can I give you a hypothetical? You have,
I believe you will anyway.
you have the same type of fact situations here, two parents working. They ultimately come to a divorce setting. They have children at home. The only factual distinction between the hypothetical in your case is each parent makes $35,000 per year.
Yes.
Can one of the parents unilaterally step back and retire?
My answer would be no. And I have no problem with standing before this court and saying no. This is a unique case. The ability to pay should always be considered. In this case, there's ability to pay. In other cases, there's not ability to pay.
Both parents make $100,000 a year.
Again, I would say no, because you don't have this discretionary income that's not needed to meet a budget.
So the principle of law is the ability to pay. It's about the money here.
That's one of the factors, Your Honor. One of the factors.
I oftentimes return to those thrilling days of yesteryear when I was on the trial court, and I use the bench book because that helps me in some of the cases.
Excellent.
And so I pulled the bench book here.
That we're not supposed to cite to the court, right?
That's right. This is not authoritative, by the way, but it refreshes my recollection, and it gives me an idea of what some of the trial court judges who put together the bench book,
sure,
how they view the law.
Yes.
And on the area of shirking, interestingly enough, right above I get, before shirking, I must have, I just photocopied part of it, I get to the high-income payers and how we deal with high-income payers
can deal with them differently. In fact, how the DWD Administrative Code 40.045 deals with high-income payers differently than others. But now getting to the shirking. The way that this appears to me, sub 5 in the latest edition, chapter 10, page 13, it says deviation from percentage standard, shirking. And then it suggests to me that the court consider the following statutory factors. And it goes through the normal statutory factors we do for child support, finances of the child, financial resources of both parents, maintenance received by either, standard of living, blah, 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 desirability that custodian remain in home as full-time parent, award of substantial periods of physical placement to both parties, extraordinary travel expenses, the whole laundry list. And that's set forth in A under 5A. And then 5B is the definition of shirking from a couple of cases. And then 5C says specific factors. And then it lists a couple of cases of specific factors of shirking. My question is this. Is part of the trial court appropriate analysis in determining a shirking case, does the trial court, as apparently appears in the bench book, go through the normal child support considerations and then put in the shirking law? Is that the analytical framework of the things that we consider?
I think that would be a good result in this court's decision to give that type of guidance, yes. And I think if that is applied to this case, the result still gets upheld. And the reason why is that one of the statutory criteria is the preferability or preference for a parent to be a custodial parent to spend time with the children. This, of course, is a split-time case. However, again, we come to the court on the record we have. The record we have before this court that was developed at trial is Dr. Werner agreeing point by point during cross-examination by Mr. Kurth with all of the questions on policy as to whether it's preferable for a child to be cared for by a parent rather than a nanny, to spend more time with a parent. The situation you have, these are quotes you can find in the record, the situation you have here is preferable to one where you've got two parents working full time and spending what time they can with the court. I'd like to address one or two things that came up during the argument and are part of my argument. One thing that I want to talk about is and this was talked about by the Chief Justice, shirking is a pejorative term, and there's a reason why it is. We've looked at Court of Appeals decisions. What I did is I looked at Supreme Court decisions. I tried to find the most recent Supreme Court decision I could find on shirking, and as often is the case, a lot of this law gets developed at the Court of Appeals level. This court says something, 10 years goes by, then a case comes before the court. Edwards versus Edwards, 1980, was the most recent pronouncement I found that really talked about shirking, and it said that it's improper for a trial court to consider earning capacity absent the finding that a court was, quote, willfully accepting employment and resultant lower pay for the purpose of reducing his ability to pay support money, close quote. That some Court of Appeals decisions reflect this language, such as Wallen versus Wallen. Others ignore it. This is really the first Court of Appeals decision that takes it on head on and says, well, motive really isn't important. That is something that this court might want to pay attention to as to whether it is going to agree with that or not. In this case, the Court of Appeals did discuss it, and contrary to this court's opinions, found that a finding of bad motive is not necessary. If this court adheres to its case law that finding of bad motive is necessary, then we have none in this case, and that's conceded.
Okay, but according to the Court of Appeals, which you may or may not want to accept, and according to Van Offern, there are two one is motivation, and two, the second prong, and they explain this in a footnote, is that the parent voluntarily fails to earn his or her full capacity. It's a voluntary and unreasonable decision.
Yes, and voluntariness, we all concede, is not part of this
right.
case.
So are you willing to say that if this was an unreasonable decision by your client, then she should not get additional support from Dr. Warner? Or do you think that's the totally wrong standard?
Well, I think that standard's correct, but I think motive is one of the factors the court has to consider when
and unreasonableness.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to address the standard of review question because that's been before the court. You know, one of the things that struck me as I was preparing for this argument is that Dr. Warner argues that there should be a complete de novo review here because the facts are undisputed. But the more I read the fact, their brief, the more I find them disputing facts. So I'm going to recite to you just some of the areas of factual dispute. They dispute whether Dr. Chen was advised by her financial counselor to expect a 10% return on her investments or whether she was advised by her financial advisor to expect a 7% return. There's Dr. Chen's testimony about what she was told, what she did, what she relied on. They argue Exhibit 5, one of the pages, talks about 7%. So that is a factual issue. There's a factual issue in the record as to the number of hours that Dr. Warner works. Dr. Chen testified that she was working 60-plus hours per week, and on several occasions she testified that Dr. Warner's record was worse, as bad or worse than hers. He testifies that he works from 8 till 5 on the weeks that he has the children, so there's a factual dispute there. We have a factual dispute as to whether her decision to reduce income was foreseeable at the time of divorce. We've got Exhibit 1 submitted in the trial record that shows that it was. And there's also a factual dispute as to whether Dr. Chen adequately explored employment opportunities. That's argued back and forth in the briefs. There's a factual dispute as to whether the benefit to the children is significant. Their contention is that children were thriving before, the children are thriving now, so what difference does it make? That's opposed to all of the testimony that she did about all of the extra activities that the children can now engage in. One of the quotes that I plucked from the record is, "Now, whenever the children engage in anything extraordinary, it is because of the time and effort I can spend with them." There may or may not be a factual dispute in the record as to the equivalency placement time. She testified that she spends 70 to 80% of the children's waking hours with them during the school year. The trial court found that she spends 60% of the time with them. So these are all things that are in the record that are factual disputes. So I'm not sure that this case is the type of case that would be ripe for de novo review, even if you were to adopt that standard.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can I ask, your opposing counsel spoke of Dr. Chen having the burden on establishing reasonableness.
I believe the case law is correct on that, Your Honor. I believe she's correct. I concede that.
Is there any dispute about the, well, obviously there's a dispute. How do you arrive at $4,000 per month in child support?
That was based on, in this case, that was based on the budget of Dr. Chen of $7,000 per month, and the undisputed testimony that her income from her investments had dwindled to $32,000 per year. So the court found that there was a shortfall of $4,333 and some cents per month. That's all spelled out in the trial court's written decision, and it awarded the $4,000 to meet her budget.
$7,000 per month, even though the children are half-time with Dr. Warner?
Yes, and the court found that Dr. Warner's budget for his half-time with the children is $8,400 per month. And in this case, because of the lifestyle that this marriage had and that these children afforded, the court didn't blink an eye at that. And I don't think that finding is disputed by opposing counsel.
So does that mean that she's providing half the support per month? If it's $7,000 and she's only getting $4,000 for him, is she providing the other $3,000 per month?
Yes. She's providing that out of the earnings on her investments.
What's she living on herself, then?
The earnings on her investments. That's what she's living on.
So the budget is for her and three children. So it's for four people.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't want to mislead anybody there. You know, one of the things that I find interesting here, and I keep talking about ability to pay, making this a unique case, and it does. In my brief, I indicated that the DWD guidelines, the support that's been awarded here is significantly less than DWD guidelines. And there is a calculator now on the Department of Workforce Development website that I think I can cite to the court. It's DWD40calculator.com. And you can go on there and you can put in their income figures and you can put in there the placement, and it factors in all kinds of things. It factors in the shared placement standards. It factors in high income payers and all that sort of thing. I ran some calculations before I put that statement in my brief. The calculations that I ran show some interesting things. In the brief of Dr. Warner, particularly in the final reply brief, they are not arguing that mother should be working her $405,000, but I did calculate that as well. They're arguing that it's unreasonable for her not to be working every other week. The testimony in the record, the only testimony in the record, were that if such a job were available, which it is not, it would be $108,000 worth of income, because that's based on the pay that you get for that type of job, even disregarding the fact that the record's undisputed that she would have $3,000 per month expenses because she has to pay for her own malpractice insurance, her own travel, and that sort of thing, which a clinic normally covers. Disregarding that, if we were to plug that figure in, $9,000 per month for mother and $45,000 per month for father, it shows that per the DWD 40 formula, Dr. Warner should be paying $8,000 per month in child support. So they're arguing impute half-time to her at minimum, and then he shouldn't have to pay. That's not the way it works out.
Yes. If I could, one more question I have.
Certainly.
Regarding the standard, and I'm looking at page 11 of the petitioner's brief. And
the blue brief. Thank you.
Which cites or at least purports to cite the original case on a trial court's reasonableness determination as giving weight as Wassenaar versus Panos. And it gives a quotation. Now, I'm actually having a case pulled now, so I haven't read it recently, but I want to go through what it quotes.
Sure.
Because the trial court's legal conclusion, that is, whether the clause is reasonable, is so intertwined with the factual findings supporting that conclusion, the appellate court should give weight to the trial court's decision, although the trial court's decision is not controlling. That seems a little bit different from what the Court of Appeals did in page 5 and 6 of its decision, which is Appendix B5, B6, yeah, where it says we interpret the standard of review from Van Offeren to mean that if a circuit court reached a conclusion that a reasonable court could reach based on the record before the court, we will defer to that conclusion. Now, it seems to be discussing the same standard of review, but coming to two different ways and two different results based on that standard. How do you explain that?
I would explain it this way, simply. Wassenaar versus Panos is not a family court case. It's still in the contract. When you get into the
liquidated damages case.
Oh, yes, you're right. Thank you. When you would know, wouldn't you?
No, I thought. Good decision.
As we all think.
Right.
In the family law case, you get into the long-established case law, which I cited in my brief, which says that when you get into areas of child support, you're dealing with areas of discretion. And you've got that overlay on top of the whole situation.
But this also seemed to be dealing with areas of discretion and intertwining facts and law. It seems to be applying the principle, but applying it differently. And in your position is you can do that because this is family law and it's different than this other body of law.
Right. All right. And my argument also is, if you disagree with me, the result still comes out, but it's still reasonable.
That I got.
Okay.
Well, if you track it all down, Nettesheim wrote Ozaukee County. And in Ozaukee County, which he quotes here, well, which is quoted here by the writer.
Yes.
In Ozaukee County, and Wassenaar says, because a trial court's conclusion is so intertwined, it gives weight. That's how they cite it in Ozaukee County. And then he moves from, or whoever wrote this, was it Lunston, moves from giving weight to defer, which can mean that here, in this case, we gave the weight and we're deferring.
Sure.
Where in another case, we're giving weight, but we're not deferring. We're not taking it on. And you're saying you don't have to take on the other, you don't have to take on the trial court's decision if you don't think it's ultimately right. You're just giving it a thumb on the scale.
Thumb on the scale, but I think you also have to, it's the age-old debate as far as the findings of fact versus the application of the law.
Sure.
One of the things that I just want to point out is that the facts or the things that are not disputed in this record that I think bear on affirming what happened here. What's not disputed in this record is that there is no part-time work available to Dr. Chen in the geographic area.
Did the trial court make that finding?
The trial court didn't do formal findings of fact, you know, where it's, like you see sometimes where they're numbered and all that sort of thing. So no, the court did not make that finding. I cannot recall whether the court addressed that in its written decision. Its written decision was medium length, didn't cover everything, so I can't remember whether it covered that or not. Other things that aren't disputed in the record are that locums tenens positions, that's the temporary, the term for temporary agencies in the medical field, locums tenens positions would take Dr. Chen beyond a reasonable commuting distance, so she would not be available to the children during the week she did not have placement if she took a locums tenens position. The other thing that's not disputed, and I talked about this in conjunction with the website, is that she would earn at best $108,000 in an every other week job, and she would have large expenses, things that a full-time employer would pay that aren't paid when you're in a part-time position. What's also not disputed is that she did have a plan to take care of herself financially when she left the clinic. And again, the reasonableness of that will be argued and has been argued. We contend that she had it's not like she went and didn't have a plan, or it's not like Van Offer where she went and had a plan where she wasn't going to make any money for 5 years beyond the time the children become adults. It was a plan where she was going to make $110,000 per year at a time that again, back to Department of Workforce Development, the DWD website will show you that the median family income in Wisconsin in 2002 was $45,000. The median family income in Wood County was $43,600-some. And against that backdrop, she's making a decision that she will be able to get $110,000 per year based on her investments. What's also not disputed is that she does intend to re-enter her career. One of the things that Dr. Chen has talked to me about is this term retirement. It's undisputed on the record that when she left employment, she had to put in her letter that she was retiring. However, she testified over and over again that she was putting her career on hold, and she testified she plans to go back into the workforce. I bring this up simply because it's a factor that's often talked about in shirking cases.
Could I ask you, what effect on this matter would there be if there were part-time work available?
None, as far as I'm concerned, because I already talked to you about what the Department of Workforce Development, Department of Workforce Development says if she's got part-time available to her, at the rates that's available to her, that Dr. Warner pays $8,000 per month. Got no effect on this case at all, except if we have a judge who doesn't agree to deviate from the guidelines, which this judge did, he'd be paying more money. So that's the only effect it would have.
But just for clarification, if I may, forget sure. that the department guidelines.
Sure.
If she had available to her part-time work, that would be a consideration in setting the amount of child support, would it not be?
It certainly is an appropriate factor, yes. And in this case, there's 5 pages of testimony by Dr. Chen as to her attempts to find part-time employment and her inability to do it. So it's not something that we're arguing isn't a factor. We're arguing that it's not available in this geographic region.
Did she get a job working at Target?
Don't know the answer to that. You know, and interestingly enough, that wasn't raised by anybody except you until just now. So, I thought about it at about midnight last night, but it's not been raised in the record at all. But the other thing that's not disputed in the record is that since Dr. Chen has put her career on hold, the girls have benefited. And the record's replete with examples of that. The oldest girl's been able to enter an art competition. She's been able to take one of the girls to a sports medicine doctor because of a knee problem with dancing. She stays for knitting, taekwondo, piano, for dancing. She helps with piano practice at her house. She helps with music theory. She works with the teachers regarding an organizationally challenged child. She volunteers at the school on a daily basis. She's there for all school events. She drives or chaperones field trips. She sells lunch tickets. All of this is set forth in the transcript. It's set forth in the Court of Appeals decision at pages 4 through 6. And it's also set forth in Exhibit 8, which is a trial court exhibit that's before the court.
I was reading the trial court's decision, and it's in the blue brief.
Right in the appendix, correct.
Yep, at page 3. And I'm wondering if this is right.
Let me see. I'll have to find it.
It's 8-5.
Thank you.
If Warner is right, and he makes a finding, whether you call it conclusional law, that there was no shirking, but he says if Warner is right about shirking, there would be shirking alleged in every arrangement involving a two-parent relationship in one which one parent predominantly attends to the party's children while the other attends to an income-producing job. And if Warner were right, it would become inappropriate to impute economic contribution to a spouse's child care or homemaking services as set forth in that statute. I think what he's saying is that she might not be making $108,000 or $250,000 or $400,000 as a physician, but that if you're going to deal with how much she is making, you have to put in the value of her homemaking.
Yes, I agree. And I believe that's what he's saying. And
it's as if, and that wasn't part of Dr. Warner's view of this. He was attributing zero to her.
Correct.
And that the trial judge says, no, you got to attribute the reasonable value of her services, which may be more if she's a physician or maybe less.
Correct.
Okay.
Maybe with a knee,
injury
from dancing, it's more. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. All right. I just want to make sure that I understood that, and that's what he was driving at.
And I believe that's what he's driving at, and I agree with that statement. My time's up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Roberson.
Jane Chen is a woman with many options, probably more options than anybody else in this room, except for Dr. Warner. She can make over $400,000 a year if she works full-time. She can make more money than most of us in this room if she works part-time. She has $1.7 million of assets that she can use to help support herself and her children. This is not a situation where she needs to or where she should be allowed to stick her former husband with the bill for a decision that she made unilaterally to change the way the parties agreed to parent their children during the marriage.
Ms. Roberson, again, looking at the trial court's decision, which is a decision not in terms of numbered findings of fact, but is a narrative. I think that's the correct way of describing it. The trial judge says on page A4, after unsuccessfully attempting to arrange part-time employment in her department, does he make it an anesthesiologist? So obviously Marshfield Clinic was not willing to give her part-time work, apparently.
That's correct.
And that's the finding of fact, right?
Yes.
Does he make any other finding of fact about the part-time work?
I believe there's evidence in the record that she applied for a couple of locum tenens positions over a couple of year period. I don't think that's ever characterized in the record as to whether that's an appropriate attempt to find employment, as Mr. Tesmatner would have it, or an inadequate attempt to find employment, as Dr. Warner would state.
Okay. Then, since the market declined, Chen, this is on A6, has made attempts to find part-time or temporary employment. The implication is that she was unsuccessful, but that attempts were made.
Two attempts.
Okay.
Mr. Tesmatner talked about facts that were disputed. But I think the material facts and the facts that are relevant to the court's decision here are not disputed. Dr. Chen and Dr. Warner share joint legal custody and equal physical placement of the children. The children are happy, healthy, and well-adjusted. During the marriage and initially after the divorce, both parents worked full-time and the children did well. These are the important facts for the court to keep an eye on in this case. This case should not become a referendum on whether children need a parent at home full-time. I hope the court won't make the mistake that the trial court and the Court of Appeals made in this area. These parents made this decision for their own family, as all parents should be able to do for their own family. We should not be legislating this either through our state legislature across the hall or by this court. Parents together need to make decisions about how best to raise their children. These parents decided that the best way they could raise their children was for both of them to work at their jobs and for both of them to participate as fully as they could in their children's rearing when they were not at work.
Counselor, but isn't it possible that one can change one's mind about what your children need after you've gone through a divorce, which has got to have some effect on the children? They're not living with both parents.
Of course it's possible. And if both parents change their minds, then that's one thing.
But you know, she reduced her own income, too.
Or if the circumstances have changed, if something has happened so that a child needs more from a parent, that's another thing. But what happened in this case was our time for the discretionary determination of child support was with the initial divorce in the initial trial court. There wasn't a trial there. These people made an agreement. They agreed to equal placement. They agreed to close to equal obligation for the children. And it is in light of that existing obligation that this court must look at Dr. Chen's decision not to be employed.
Do we look at what's in the best interest of the children at all in this analysis?
In a child support determination initially, trial court's making a child support determination at the time of the divorce.
What about, you know, I know this isn't, you know, the law, but in the bench book, it would have us go through
the trial judge to go through all of the standard factors, it appears, you know, which, of course, go to the best interest of the child.
I believe the law is shirking, and I do agree with my colleague that it's an unfortunate term, but it's the one we've got. Once you have that child support obligation established to begin with, which is done after consideration of all of the statutory factors, which include the best interests of the children and include the earning capacity of the parents, without weighting any one factor more or less than the others. After that decision is made and the child support obligation is established, and when the question becomes, is one person not carrying his or her fair weight? At that point, in the shirking analysis, the issue is simple, it's narrow, it's limited. It's, is the parent's decision with respect to employment reasonable in light of his or her own child support obligation?
Your answer to Justice Bradley is no.
That's correct.
So my read, and that's okay, my reading of this in terms of for deviation from percentage standard shirking is that you, in this situation, you don't go through the analysis of the normal 767 factors.
Unless circumstances have changed, Your Honor, I believe you do not go through that analysis again.
And the fact that she's left work and can't get partial employment is not a change of circumstance, in your opinion.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But thank you, Ms. Roberson, and thank you, Mr. Tess-Matner, for your arguments in an unusual child support case. And I'm sure the Court has found the arguments very enlightening. That concludes our hearing on 03-0288, Jane E. Chen versus John J. Warner. And the Court is in recess until our next oral argument later in this month. And the Court will meet in the conference room at 3:10.